now to the war on drugs, as it was declared by former President Nixon. And you know, we're at this point where we have the highest levels of overdose that we've ever seen. So,
and that is Melissa Moore. She's the director of the Drug Policy Alliance. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, November 30th, 2021. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.
And the previous program was the WBAI Evening News, heard daily at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion Radio here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
Welcome to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to press for action on the climate emergency. For today, we are continuing our series on militarism and our climate crisis. And our subject today concerns the intersection of militarism, climate change, and immigration. To help us navigate through this issue, we've invited Laura Steichen to speak with us. Laura Steichen is the outreach coordinator for the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, a project that produces research and analysis on the federal budget and militarized spending. In this role, Laura collaborates with advocates and movement leaders, organizing to dismantle U.S. militarism, divest from militarized spending, and reclaim our resources to invest in a regenerative, life-giving economy. She is also the co-author of the study the project produced called No Warming, No War: How Militarism Fuels the Climate Crisis and Vice Versa. Laura, welcome to Extinction Rebellion.
Hi, thank you for having me.
No Warming, No War covers a broad range of topics. The carbon emissions of the U.S. military and Pentagon, our wars for oil, how our federal spending, for example, on the war machine hamstrings our ability to address climate change and a broad swath of other needs. So this is really a broad study, which I encourage everyone to download and read. But we're going to hone in on the section entitled Climate Change, Immigration, and Militarization. Now, in the beginning of this section, you write that, quote, climate change and border militarization are inextricably linked, end quote. I want you to walk listeners through this idea. First, what do you mean by border militarization? Explain to listeners what's happening at our borders.
Sure. And thanks again for having me and for inviting this conversation. When we talk about border militarization, what we're talking about is the sort of hyper-securitization of the U.S. borderlands, particularly the United States southern border. And so what we've seen is that on the U.S.-Mexico border, this region has really undergone significant military escalations in recent decades, where we see really the influence of military strategies, culture, technology, hardware, and even combat veterans themselves in place in the policing of borders. And this military influence, sort of broadly characterized, creates what we recognize today as a very militarized border region, right? So in this case, the border region really resembles something akin to an imagined war zone. And this is all fueled by a bloated border enforcement budget that funds increasing numbers of armed border patrol agents and a range of surveillance technologies from drones, aircrafts, and sensors to facial recognition and human detection technologies. So we see that military contractors, like big ones like Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, these corporations repurpose weapons, surveillance technologies, and vehicles for use in the United States, right? So Customs and Border Protection, also known as CBP, for example, has the largest U.S. drone fleet of its kind outside of the Department of Defense. They use Predator B drones that were built for military use but have been used by CBP since 2006. CBP, which includes the Border Patrol, is also the largest law enforcement organization in the world, and nearly one-third of CBP agents are themselves military veterans, right? So these are all examples of the ways that border and immigration enforcement in the United States today really sort of blurs these distinctions between security, policing, militarization, and war making.
You know, I was struck by this piece in your in the study, just a little blurb. It says that these drones, you were talking about the drones, these drones cost the federal government $32,000 every time they're used to apprehend an individual. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's significant. And it's important to put those resources in perspective when the United States talks about a lack of resources to resettle refugees, for example. But I'm sure we'll dive more into that later.
Exactly. Your tax dollars at work.
Your tax dollars. Now, this militarization has been building up for decades, you say. Can you give us a little history? So it's not just, you know, recent. It's been going on for quite some time. Could you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah. So the militarization of the U.S. borderlands has been building up for quite some time. It's certainly been escalating in recent decades. An sort of early example of the kinds of border militarization that we see today was the transfer of surveillance technology used by the U.S. military in Vietnam to the U.S.-Mexico border in the 1970s. In the 1980s, we saw sort of another buildup of militarized border infrastructure that was sort of implemented under the guise of drug enforcement efforts and the war on drugs. In the 90s, after the National American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, was passed, there was another significant surge in border militarization alongside a significant increase in the border security budget, sort of in anticipation of and in response to a wave of migration that's been called the NAFTA exodus in Latin America. And then, of course, as I think we're all a little bit more familiar with, although maybe not, we've seen, you know, sort of those trends have been sort of turbocharged in the last two decades since 9/11.
Well, maybe not, because people who are in their 20s now were either not born or little bitty children when 9/11, in the aftermath of 9/11. Could you talk a little bit about how it did change after 9/11? What were the significant changes?
Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me of, you know, sometimes you'll see on social media, like on Twitter, it'll be like, retweet if you were born after ICE. And what that's referring to is probably the most significant change in border policy since 9/11 was the creation of the Department of Homeland Security itself. And this is the federal department that manages immigration enforcement, which was formed in 2003. As a part of the federal government's war on terror apparatus. And so a little bit of history: the Department of Homeland Security rolled 22 different federal departments and agencies into a single department, right? So you have FEMA, TSA, the Coast Guard, the Secret Service, all these various agencies were all brought under DHS. And then critically, and really sort of transforming the apparatus of border and immigration enforcement in the United States, the department also absorbed the pre-existing immigration agency, which prior to the creation of DHS was called the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And it transferred the functions of that agency into three new agencies within DHS. So I'll just outline those quickly. There's U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, which administers citizenship and naturalization services, so like visa applications, for example. There's Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, which is tasked with the very punitive immigration law enforcement, including immigration detention and deportation. And then there's Customs and Border Protection, CBP, which is the agency tasked with enforcing border policies and includes the Border Patrol. So all these institutions might feel somewhat ingrained today in how our government and immigration policy operates, but they're very new, less than 20 years old. And originally, these immigration agencies were included in this new department, again, created in the shadow of 9/11, because of a fear that immigration and unsecured borders would be sort of these gateways for terrorism, or at least that was sort of the messaging. But what we've seen over the course of the last two decades is that in reality, DHS has just militarized the border and disrupted immigrant communities, even where there's, you know, absolutely no claim of terrorist threat. Alongside this, there, like I said before, have been massive funding increases to ICE and CBP. And remember, those two are the agencies that are responsible for sort of profiling, jailing, deporting immigrants. So since 9/11, in the past two decades, spending on ICE and CBP has more than doubled. And to put that sort of in perspective, that spending has been six times greater than what was spent on citizenship and naturalization services. So these sort of violent punitive agencies are receiving significantly more funding than an agency that's tasked with, like, for example, processing asylum cases. During that same period, over the same two decades since 9/11, spending on ICE and CBP was more than twice the funding for the CDC, even accounting for pandemic spending in 2020 and 2021. And so what we see is that after 9/11, really ballooning budgets to DHS have facilitated this sort of rapid growth in federal spending to agencies that militarize the border region and immigrant communities.
So in effect, the federal government is spending six times to punish immigrants what they spend to naturalize and resettle immigrants.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and a great point, how ICE feels like it's so much a part of what the federal government is and does, and yet it's a quite new agency, almost brand new in the scheme of governmental history.
You know what, Matt, this is the other thing that came to mind, is that the federal government is the largest employer in the nation. And so what that means also is that people's livelihoods and people are invested in this infrastructure because it's also about their jobs and so forth. So what that does is create communities invested in these kinds of policies and what these institutions do.
Yeah, that's such a good point.
You are listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. We are speaking today with Laura Steichen about militarism, immigration, and our climate crisis. Laura is Outreach Coordinator for the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Crucial, Laura, to border militarization has been the creation and propagation of stories about immigrants and immigration that have been used to justify the militarization. One might call them narratives, one might call them myths about immigrants and immigration. Can you talk about some of these stories?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, sort of in many cases, we've seen the very same language used to justify war and foreign military intervention used to justify the militarization of borders and immigration enforcement. And in that case, there's sort of a threat narrative where migration is conflated with an invasion or with a sort of quote unquote security threat. And thereby migrants are characterized as criminal or terrorist. And it's often used to sort of paint immigration as dangerous. And this characterization, I mean, it's certainly visible across media, but it's very visible within Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security reports themselves. There's a sort of one of the most striking examples that I often bring up is this 2003 Pentagon Commission reports, which advised the United States to build sort of, it used the word defensive fortresses, to hold back what it characterized as quote unquote unwanted starving immigrants from Latin America and the Caribbean. These are the people that are displaced by climate change, the report is projecting. And so, you know, what this push to militarize the border region and villainize immigrants really ignores is the real reasons that people choose to leave their homes and cross borders, when in fact, you know, US policies, whether that be economic or climate or foreign policies are often directly responsible for much of the migration towards the United States. And so you're exactly right that these dominant narratives really function both to sort of obscure the realities of what causes migration and how the United States also, you know, really ought to respond.
You know, as our borders have been increasingly militarized, our climate crisis has been unfolding at a breathtaking pace. Can you speak to how our climate crisis and border militarization became inextricably linked? And it's really important, I think, the stories around who immigrants are and what they represent is very much important. It's very much an important aspect of that.
As you've said, people around the world are, you know, already experiencing the devastating impacts of climate change. And in coming decades, climate change, alongside, you know, a range of other compounding crises, inequality, violence, pandemics, to name a few, will most certainly make corners of the globe increasingly uninhabitable. And that means people will need to move, right? And a huge portion of those displaced by climate change are what's called internally displaced people, someone who's forced to leave home by who remains within their country's borders. But it's also true that on a warming planet, migration across borders will rise. And like you said, this sort of feeds into these questions about how immigrants are characterized and what narratives we have around immigration. Because in the United States, instead of responding with solidarity or with compassion or with a sense of responsibility, instead of sort of sharing resources that we have clearly a huge amount of, if you look at the amounts of resources going towards drones, for example, you know, so instead of sharing those resources to provide refuge to those forced to travel across border, migrants are met with expanded border enforcement and repression. And this is what this writer, Christian Parenti, has called the politics of the armed lifeboat, which I think is a really good image. And this is sort of a climate response based not on mitigating the damage of climate change or preparing to cope with the impacts, but on sort of arming ourselves up to control resources and shutting down borders to refugees.
So you have people who have grown up on these stories of immigrants as being terrorists, and you know that we have to keep them out. They're drug dealers, et cetera, et cetera. And so these folks are going to ask the question: well, why is it a problem to frame the climate crisis as a national security issue? I mean, if these folks are coming through our borders, it's not just a resource issue, but it's also an issue of our own personal security. How do you answer a question: why is it a problem to frame the climate crisis as a national security issue?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at first glance, you know, even for people on the left who may not have the same sort of xenophobic impulses as other groups, this sort of frame as climate change as a national security issue, like, kind of sounds like a good thing, I think, to a lot of people. Because, yeah, certainly, after all, climate change at its core threatens every person and every community's ability to be safe and secure. But regardless of what security sort of really means and how it's really achieved, it's important that we look closely at what this concept of security and national security means to policymakers, who are the ones that are sort of allocating resources. And the reality is that in the United States, national security apparatuses are just completely militarized. And national security is pursued through massive military budgets and global military projects. And so embracing climate change as a national security issue often ends up looking at climate change through a militarized frame that promotes a search for military solutions. And this is a problem not only in that it doesn't get us anywhere in addressing the climate crisis, but it also leads us towards sort of eco-fascist and militarized responses to climate change. And so I guess that's not totally responding to the way you framed the question, because that's sort of more how you would explain to somebody on the left that climate change should not be framed as a national security issue. But I think that's a good place to start, because actually a lot of people, even that are sort of in climate movements, have sort of embrace this framework. And it's really critical that we sort of see through it and really name it as a false solution, especially in the context of already bloated and growing militarized spending. Two-thirds of the discretionary budget that Congress allocates every year goes to the military and other militarized agencies like DHS. And so we really have to avoid climate change sort of becoming yet another security issue requiring more militarism and justifying a bigger military budget. Because, clearly the real threats we face don't have military solutions.
So I have a question about the past and a question about the future. Question about the past. If I was following your kind of historical explanation earlier correctly, the ramp up in border militarization was really a transfer of resources from Vietnam. Is that right? Like it happened after the Vietnam War, not that Vietnam caused it, but as Vietnam was wound down, there were all these national security related resources and they put them on the southern border of the United States instead of in Southeast Asia. Is it something like, is that about the right story? What's the sequence there?
Yeah, that certainly took place. I don't know that, I wouldn't say I have enough expertise to be able to say that that's when that started, like that was the starting point. I think clearly we know that this sort of U.S. violence has taken place long before, that era. But yeah, sort of one example of this sort of transfer of military equipment to the U.S. borderlands was, the sort of transfer of this surveillance technology that was being used in the war in Vietnam. Once that conflict wound down, those technologies were sort of implemented on the U.S.-Mexico border. And so this sort of follows a trend that we see today of different corporations who supply the U.S. government and the U.S. military with equipment for military interventionism abroad are also sort of shucking those same products to DHS and to folks that are implementing border policies to sort of impose the same strategies along the U.S.-Mexico border.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM New York, and you are listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. We're speaking with Laura Steichen about solidarity over security as a response to our climate crisis. Laura is the outreach coordinator for the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Now, I said I had a question about the future. We are curious about what happens with borders in the years to come as the world continues to heat up, gets significantly hotter than it already is. On this show, we've previously suggested that migration from Central America will increase massively. And the last week, there was a collective intelligence assessment from all 18 U.S. intelligence agencies that predicted the same thing. And they said it would be because of climate. What do you see happening? What should we look out for in the years to come?
Yeah, so exactly right. In October, the Biden administration sort of released this suite of reports outlining the administration's view of how climate change poses a national security threat and how institutions like the Pentagon, the Department of Homeland Security plan to respond. And predictably, more often than not, these reports sort of reinforce opportunities for militarized responses to the impacts of climate change, right? So rather than really advocating to address the root causes of the crisis, military and other security strategists are quick to highlight the ways that they can continue to do the same things they've always done, but within the context of a climate change future. So what does that look like in the context of migration? As we've already acknowledged, climate change is already impacting flows in migration. More migration is pretty much inevitable. And with the sort of trajectory that we're on, military empires like the United States will continue to embrace this sort of Fortress America mentality where borders are hardened and displaced people are met with military repulsion. And so again, this is why it's so critical that we're really vigilant against these national security frameworks for addressing, for addressing climate change. Because if we're not, we're only going to see the militarization of borders get worse. And we're only going to see that militarization that's happening on, for example, the US-Mexico borderlands continue to expand well beyond the borderlands, both within the homeland and to other countries. That's something we're already seeing. And so for those of us who are advocates for climate justice, especially those of us in the global north, it's really incumbent upon us to embrace the demands of migrant justice movements. And I think a really critical part of that is disavowing these false solutions that are put forward by the national security state.
Laura, thank you so much for speaking with us about these issues. It's been a pleasure having you on this show.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation.
All right, you're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio. We've had the pleasure of talking to Laura Steichen, the Outreach Coordinator for the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. We will see you next week.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
$10 a month. It's the price of a gigabyte of data for that iPad you never use. It's two overpriced coffees you ordered when you forgot to look at the menu. It's your overzealous attempts to meet the credit card minimum at the bodega on the corner. But $10 a month could be a lot more. Become a BAI buddy and commit to a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. This money will help us continue to broadcast the thoughts and perspectives of the progressive public. A BAI buddy is also not without perks. Your monthly contribution will earn you a WBAI tote bag and a member card offering Zipcar sales, discounted meals at select restaurants, and a handful of other benefits. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI, and our diverse programming will reflect your voice. Go to givetowbai.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
November 8, 2021 is the notice date to propose Pacifica bylaws amendments. The proposed amendments may be found on the Foundation's website at www.pacifica.org for review. Votes by the Pacifica National Board and the various local station boards regarding said amendments will occur thereafter.
Join us on November 26th to December 12th at Cinema Village, Sinopolis, and virtually as we celebrate 29 years of the ADIFF, the film festival that always brings you great films about people of color all over the world. Discover over 70 entertaining and revealing fiction and documentary films, including 38 world, U.S., and New York premieres. The African Diaspora International Film Festival from November 26th to December 12th. For tickets and schedule, go to nyadiff.org or call 212-864-1760. That's 212-864-1760. Enjoy your world on the big screen.
Forward it. sing these songs of freedom, 'cause all I ever have, redemption songs.
And the previous program was Extinction Rebellion Radio. Heard Tuesdays right after the WBAI Evening News, 6:30 p.m. Tuesdays.